Welcome to the Scottsdale Big Book Study, where we will study the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today's date is Saturday, March 30th, 2024. My name is Dottie, and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey. I will be your host for today's study. Our co-host is Veronica C. If you have any question during the meeting, please contact either myself or any of the co-hosts by private message in the chat function. The chat function will be disabled until 5 minutes before the question and answer session. Please note that the speaker, Harlan G., will be recorded for the duration of the study. However, the question and answer session, which follows, will not be recorded. We ask if you can please make sure you keep your microphone on mute at all times during today's study. And also, please turn off your video if you're exercising, eating, or if you need to step away from your screen for any reason. During the meeting, we will post the link to our seventh tradition. This money goes toward the cost of our Zoom account, the cost of uploading our recordings, and we will also send contributions to our inner group and WSO. We will post a link to the previous week's recordings. These are available by clicking on a link that will be posted in the chat box. I will now gratefully turn the meeting over to Harlan G.
Thanks, Dottie. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's so nice to be here. And as I say, every weekend, it is just gorgeous here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I hope it is as absolutely stunning wherever you are, whether you're listening on Podbean. Podcast or whatever it is, I hope it's absolutely stunning where you are as well. We are here this morning and we are going to study chapter 2, There Is a Solution. And this is the very first chapter that was written for this book. This book came about as an idea in 1937. They believed that they needed to do three things, and thank the good Lord, only one of those three things came to reality. They believed that they needed to start a chain of hospitals across the country. In those days, it was very difficult to get an alcoholic into a hospital because a lot of times doctors had to fudge the diagnosis, because hospitals did not want you housed in there just for your alcoholism. Now, there were other things. Many had ulcers, gastritis. They had other conditions, but as strictly an alcoholic, they didn't really want you. Alcoholics are also famous for not paying their bills. That was another reason they didn't want you too. They were very famous for not paying their bills. And they wanted to start a chain of hospitals, and Dr. Bob would be the head physician at this chain of hospitals. And they also wanted to do another thing. And the other thing they wanted to do was they wanted to have paid missionaries going forward through the country proselytizing AA. They wanted to hire these missionaries, and the head missionary was going to be Bill Wilson. In other words, we would have a group of paid professionals going around proselytizing this way of life, paid missionaries. And then they said they needed a book so that the message could not be garbled. It couldn't be garbled. At first, what would happen is this guy would get sober, so everybody would sort of do what this guy did. And then he would lose his sobriety or something. And then they would say, okay, we're going to follow this guy. He's getting good results. We'll follow him. But what Bill Wilson knew is that the message was getting garbled. And they wanted a message that was written down, codified, so that it could not be changed or garbled. And that's what they wanted. And thank God the only thing that came to fruition was this book. Now, for thousands and thousands of years, alcoholics were treated horribly. There was no hope. There was no solution. There was no nothing. There was no program of recovery. There was nothing. And for thousands and thousands of years, people that were afflicted with alcoholism, people that were afflicted with drug addiction, people that were afflicted with any type of addiction whatsoever, were basically written off. They were written off, and they would go into insane asylums. If you remember back when we were telling the story of Ebby, and Ebby was in Manchester, Vermont, and how he drove through a woman's kitchen. And they said to Ebby, "We're going to remand you to the insane asylum in Brattleboro, Vermont." Well, what is an insane asylum going to do for Ebby? All it's going to do is warehouse him so that he can't get to liquor. That's all it's going to do. It's going to warehouse him. And then maybe at some point, somebody will be able to get him out of there if they could show a judge that he was okay. And then, of course, he would go back, because what do alcoholics do when you let them out and they have access to liquor? They start drinking again. And, you know, they don't pick up where they left off. They pick up worse because of the progressive nature of the disease. But if you remember back to the story that I told you of Ebby, Ebby was about to be remanded to Brattleboro Insane Asylum. If you remember back in that same section of Bill's story, when Bill is hospitalized for the second time, Dr. Silkworth becomes convinced that Bill is an alcoholic. And he tells Lois, "You're either going to have to lock him up, or he's going to go insane. He's going to get wet brain, and he's going to going to have to institutionalize him, or he's going to die." And Lois was very upset by this. What Dr. Silkworth didn't tell Lois, and what the judge and the police didn't tell Ebby, was, "Hey, we have a thing you can do, or a place you can go to and get recovery." Now, why didn't they say that to him? Because it didn't exist. See, Silkworth knew the problem, but he didn't have a solution. And then along comes this Oxford group, didn't care about the problem, didn't really know of a solution or care about a solution, but because they were working spiritual tenets, not steps yet, but tenets, the six tenets of the Oxford group movement that we discussed 2 weeks ago or so, the six tenets of the Oxford group movement were things that were very highly effective for Ebby Thatcher. And they were, number one, complete deflation. Number two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Number three, a moral inventory. Number four, confession. Number five, restitution. Number six, continued work with other alcoholics, which originally in the Oxford group was give testimony to what Jesus had done for you. Remember that the Oxford group movement was not AA. It was a Christian movement. So they would go give testimony about what Christ had done for them. And this is what Ebby was endeavoring to do when he called on Bill that November night. And then they had their four absolutes. If you're wondering how you can write these down, the absolutes are not in there. But I'm reading on page 263 in the fourth edition. 263 in the fourth edition. And when we start, we're going to start on page 17 of the fourth edition. But the six steps as adapted for AA from the Oxford group movement are on page 263. And they had their four absolutes. And the absolutes are absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And these alcoholics were having trouble being absolutely anything other than absolutely drunk. So these absolutes became very impossible goals, because who can be absolutely honest, absolutely pure, absolutely unselfishness, and have absolute love? You know, nobody's perfect. Nobody's perfect means nobody's perfect. You know, nobody's perfect. So we have a human condition that really prevents us from being absolutely anything but human. We're human. You know, nobody's perfect. So the bottom line, let's go back to page 17. So the bottom line is that there was nothing they could do for these men, primarily, or women. And what happened to women alcoholics was far more nightmarish, if such a thing can be said. And it's true. It was far more nightmarish than what happened to the men. The women were treated horribly, because if a man is an alcoholic or was an alcoholic, he was considered a sot, a drunk, a bum. If a woman was an alcoholic, not only is she a bum and a drunk and a sot and a lush, but she's considered other things too. And the abuse of women alcoholics, women drug addicts, was infinitely more grotesque than the abuse of the men. The men didn't face the abuse, some of the abuses that women faced. And it was a horrible, horrible situation. And again, we have page 17. There is a solution. Now, I talked about this last week, but we are going to review it again, especially for those who were not there last week. The title of this chapter, and by the way, once again, I want to remind you, this was the first chapter written for this book. There Is a Solution was the first chapter, and the second chapter written was more about alcoholism. He didn't start the book like you see it, because Dr. Silkworth didn't write his opinion until December of 38, and then it was stuck in there as chapter one, and then they moved it to the Roman numeral section later on. But in the first edition of the big book, the doctor's opinion was chapter one. Then they, in the second edition, it was moved to the Roman numeral section, and the reason is because the book is supposed to be for alcoholics by alcoholics, and Dr. Silkworth was not an alcoholic. So as such, it was moved to the Roman numeral section. But without Dr. Silkworth's opinion, there's no program. It doesn't make any sense, because you're endeavoring to get a solution and we don't know what the problem is. So Dr. Silkworth's opinion is vital to the understanding of the book, and it wouldn't flow like it does without Dr. Silkworth's opinion, because, again, not to be repetitive, without Dr. Silkworth, you don't know what the problem is. So how does it make any sense that we're looking at solution when you don't know what the problem is? So anyway, I've said that enough, but there is a solution. Now, we put the emphasis on is. There is a solution. Now, if you remember back when, before we started the doctor's opinion, I told you that for thousands of years, literally, alcoholism was viewed as stupidity, lack of willpower, lack of character, lack of discipline. You know how a non-compulsive overeater can say to you, "Oh my God, look how much weight you've gained. Why don't you push yourself away from the table?" Well, that's easy to say if you're not a compulsive overeater. You know, I'm not an alcoholic and I'm not a drug addict. I can easily say to somebody, "Why don't you just not drink alcohol?" I have not had, on July the 4th of this year, it'll be 48 years since I've had a drink. Now, how do I know that? Because on July the 4th, 1976, my boss at Wrigley Field, when I was a vendor, said to us, "Have a beer." Well, when the boss tells you to have a beer, you have a beer. And so I did. I didn't drink the whole beer. I threw it out. But I had a drink of beer, and I haven't touched liquor since. I remember that, so it's going to be on July 4th, 48 years. Well, somebody might say, 48 years? Wow, you're amazing. No, I'm not amazing. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't like the taste of liquor. I don't like the smell of liquor. I don't like anything about liquor. I would much rather have a McDonald's milkshake. I would much rather have a chocolate Yoo-hoo or a KO or chocolate milk than liquor any day of the week. And, you know, if I'm going to take in the amount of calories that liquor puts in me, I would much rather do that with food than with liquor any day of the year. So the world was telling alcoholics, simply don't drink or just have one or two and stop. I can do that. I'm not alcoholic. They can't. But so there was a misunderstanding there, as there is today. How many of you, you don't have to show your hands, but how many of you that are here right now have been told by doctors and adults and anybody who will talk to you, why don't you just eat half? Why don't you just push yourself away from the table? Why don't you just eat this or eat that or eat, you know, the big thing when I was a kid was cottage cheese. For some reason, I don't know what happened in the 1960s and part of the 70s, but cottage cheese, if you were eating it, it meant you were really serious about losing weight. And the truth of the matter is, cottage cheese is no panacea. If you're eating full fat or even skim cottage cheese or, you know, fat free, there's no panacea there. But for whatever reason, when I was a little boy, and they would bring out, if you went to a restaurant and you got the diet plate, they would bring you peaches soaked in sugar, cottage cheese, and maybe a little something else or whatever. But that was the staple of what it was you were expected to eat if you were trying to lose weight, was cottage cheese. I don't know where that mishigas came from. Mishigas is craziness. That mishigas came from that somehow cottage cheese was the great panacea. But it was. And there was no solution that anybody knew about. And it is horrible to think of the lives, not just of the families and friends of alcoholics and drug addicts, but what could have been. You know, the saddest words of tongue or pen are these few words, it might have been. The creativity, the knowledge, the skill, the aptitude of alcoholics as unleashed by the recovery is astounding, and yet we will never benefit from their knowledge, their skill, their creativity, what they could have done in art or music or business or industry or science. We will never know. Medicine, we will never know, because they were either institutionalized, left for dead, or jailed. How sad for all of us that that was the reality. Hopefully we can work harder at getting away from wasting the lives in our world. So there is a solution, because we talked about Solomon, King Solomon of the Old Testament. And he said, you know, I believe that alcoholism is an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no remedy for it. Notice I didn't use the word cure. There is no cure. He didn't have a remedy for alcoholism. And then in the 1640s in England, we had Dr. Trotter. Dr. Trotter wrote a paper in England in the 1640s. And his paper, he says he believes that alcoholism is an illness, but he had no remedy for it. He had no remedy. Now, in 1790, right here in the United States, we had a man, and he wrote a paper, and in 1790, he believed alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no remedy for it. He was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. His name was Benjamin Rush, Dr. Benjamin Rush. And that's where Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital gets its name in Chicago. And Dr. Bob, see, God likes to laugh too. He likes to leave his little signature on things. Dr. Bob did his internship at Rush Medical College in Chicago, so named for Dr. Rush. Dr. Rush treated, to the best of his ability, Charles Adams. John Adams was the second president of the United States. He was the first vice president, and he was the second president. And he had a son named Charles, who was an alcoholic. And Dr. Rush tried to treat Charles, but Dr. Rush was unable to help Charles, and Charles died of his alcoholism, leaving behind a young wife and several young children, and he died of his alcoholism. Now, along comes Dr. Silkworth, and he takes over as medical director at Towns Hospital in 1929, November of 29, after the Great Depression starts. And Dr. Silkworth formulates his opinion. And his opinion is allergy of the body, twist of the mind, not a matter of willpower, not a matter of character, not a matter of discipline, not a matter of anything, but an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind. And then along comes Ebby, who was the last chain between Roland and Dr. Jung and Seba Graves Jr. and Seba Graves Sr. and all of these links in the chain that God set up as the tapestry of our history. See, a lot of people, they think Bill met Bob and AA sprang out of their ears. Nothing could be further from the truth. Because if you take out one link of the chain, Ebby, Jung, Roland, if you don't know who these people are, listen to some of my podcasts on Bill's story. Ebby, Jung, Roland, Seba Graves Sr., Seba Graves Jr., the Oxford Group, Sam Shoemaker, all of it comes together. And Bill Wilson knows the problem, but he doesn't have a solution for it. He knows the problem because he was treated by Silkworth. Ebby knows the solution, but he doesn't know the problem. And when Ebby comes to see Bill Wilson in November of 1934, Bill Wilson becomes that nexus. He becomes that confluence. A confluence is when two rivers come together and they always form a mightier river than the original two, because they come together. And Bill Wilson hears the solution, sees the solution, and he puts it together with the problem, and we have what we have. So let's look at the title on page 17. There is a solution. That's a good promise. Now there's something else. Now I want to predicate by saying this. Some people get very offended when I say this, because some people, and I have no problem. You know, it says in the big book, we have no monopoly on God. Some people say, I recover from the OA workbook. I recover from the OA 12 and 12. I recover from this, or I recover from that. God bless you, and that's fine. I'm not being critical. I'm not being critical. We have no monopoly on God. For me, this is my time. When you get your big book study and you have your time, you can talk about how you recover. For me, I recover because there is a solution, because I always have a problem making decisions. When I have to make a decision, frequently I try to figure out what you want me to do and choose that so that you won't abandon me. It is only in the last 10, 15 years that I know how to make a decision based on what I want, based on what I feel, based on what I think. That took a long time. It took a long time. Took till I was in my mid-50s until I was able to do that. Now I can. Now I can shoot from the hip. So there is a solution, means I don't have to make decisions on how to recover. I just use the big book of AA, and that seems to work for me. Again, before you pick up the phone, before you start texting me, before you start calling New Mexico and reporting me, I am not knocking anything else. I'm not criticizing anything else. I'm talking about what works for me. That's all I'm talking about. All right, let's go to page 17. There is a solution. There is a solution. Either way is good. All right, now let's go to page 17. And what do we see here? We see we, not I, we of Alcoholics Anonymous. What's the first word of the first step? We admitted we were powerless over food. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Okay. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. Notice he doesn't say everybody has recovered. Why not? Why does he say in chapter 5, rarely have we seen the person fail who has thoroughly followed our path? The reason he uses language like this is because Bill Wilson understood well that we are immature, sensitive rebels. We are immature, perfectionistic, sensitive rebels. And if he puts everybody's going to recover, somebody is going to buck against that, and they're going to say, oh yeah, I'm going to be the first one not to recover. So he knew very well, he knew the mind of the alcoholic. And the mind of an alcoholic is the mind of an immature, perfectionistic, sensitive rebel. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. Once again, what are we alluding to? We're trying to raise your curiosity to think, if they have recovered, what did they do? What do I have to do to be like them? What do I have to do? We are average Americans. Now, remember that this was written in 1937. Only God saw that by now, AA would be in 170 countries or 175 countries, and OA is in 60 countries. But the bottom line is, we are average Americans is appropriate because in 1937, who knew? I mean, literally, who knew? All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. Now, when you think about, there's 130 of you, 127 of you here now, and I'm still thinking of moving this to an earlier time because I think we'd get more people if it wasn't right in the middle of the Saturday for a lot of people. But anyway, that's for another time. What was I going with that? Oh, okay. What do we have in common, most of us? Absolutely nothing. And yet, let's look at the next sentences here. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding, which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Steerage is the cheapest form of passage on a ship. It's the cheese sandwich section. If you're in the captain's table, you're in the top group. If you're in steerage, you're lucky if they throw you a moldy cheese sandwich. You're below deck. You don't get to look out at the ocean from your room. You have cheap, very economical, almost institutional kind of accommodations. But if you go up a deck or two and you're in third class, then you're in second class, then you're in first class. Everything is beautiful. And then if you're the right color, the right religion, the right background, you can eat at the captain's table where everything is the finest of the finest. So, but there, when just take the Titanic, when these guys, when their butts hit that freezing cold water, I don't think they were looking for financial statements from each other. They were asking themselves a question: how in the hell are we going to survive? And there was a camaraderie. Now, let's take a look. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. I have been very blessed. I was never lucky at love. I was never lucky in romance ever in my life, ever. I went on my first date with a girl. I was 35 years old. I never had much luck. Any female that I had any type of relationship with ended up going their own way. Very painful. However, hopefully that won't happen this time. But however, I've had many good friends. Every day of my life, I talk to people that not only knew me prior to grammar school, but I went through grammar school with them. I went through high school with them. I went through life with them. I've known them for a long, long time. And I also have friends that I have not known for very long, but I love them dearly as well. However, I could pick any one of you out of this lineup, whether you're male, whether you're female, black, white, green, yellow, gay, straight, Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, I don't care what you are. I'm going to have more in common with you and an understanding with you than I could ever have with the boys. They're not boys now, they're 70, but with the guys I went to grammar school with and have known my whole life. They still to this day think that I used to be extremely fat and somehow I got smart and I stuck to my diet and that's how I lost the weight. They have some idea that I go to these meetings. They have some idea as to something I'm doing with you right now. They don't really understand it. And they don't understand why I'm still here, because I've lost the weight. I'm smart now. I was stupid then. Now I'm smart. Now I get it. Now I've gotten it. Now I'm arrived at a normal body weight. Why do I have to keep going to this? And many of them, if I sat and said to them, I'm scared, I'm angry, I'm lonely, I'm fill in the blank, they would look at me like, what the hell are you talking about? They don't do feelings. They don't get feelings. Maybe they've had a feeling of loss when someone died, like a parent, or in some cases, they've been like I have, they've been through a divorce or a breakup and they have some feelings. Their idea of what this is about, not OA, life is about, is you go and you get another girl. You go, you have a couple of drinks, you go to a bar, you meet a girl, whatever happens, happens. Don't really understand the language of the heart. They neither speak it nor understand it. It is not anything that they could grasp. They're brilliant boys, brilliant, Many of them were highly successful in business. I have friends who are dentists, CPAs, lawyers, doctors, rabbis. I mean, I have friends that run the gamut. This is, you might as well be speaking Swahili to them when it comes to this. I've tried at times to sort of explain it to them. I might as well try to teach a Labrador retriever how to do algebra. I would probably have better luck. So you as a group speak and understand the language of the heart. When I'm at a convention, when I'm at a retreat, one of the most beautiful things is I see people that I either have never met actually, but I've known them through vision, or I've known them through our Scottsdale Zoom meetings, whatever. Now I finally meet them, or I meet them, I see them once a year, maybe at the birthday, whatever have you. And we can sit down and have the most intimate and beautiful conversations. And it's a joy to behold. Not that I'm going to sit and tell them how, you know, what my password is at the bank or my routing number and my account number. That's not necessary. But I can sit and discuss with them. I'm scared. Here's why. I'm angry. Here's why. I'm going through this. What do you think? And we can discuss these things in ways I cannot discuss them in any other arena of my life. Cannot do it. Only you understand this language of the heart, and only you speak the language of the heart. I cannot go anywhere else and hear people speaking the language of the heart. When I was a little boy, I got this idea. And I got this idea because it was my reality. The idea that I got was these ideas about food, the way I eat, the way I want to eat, the way I think about food, the way I react to food were unique and secret unto me. That no one understood these things. And I began to ask God regularly to kill me because I knew that there was nobody I could talk to. Doctors didn't understand. Teachers, rabbis did not understand. Nobody understood. Even the people that ate like me didn't really get it because there was no recovery there. We could talk about the fact that we liked certain pancakes, certain milkshakes, certain cheeseburger, whatever it was, hamburgers, whatever. That we could swap notes on. But we couldn't swap notes about recovery. We couldn't swap notes about life because the only thing we had in common was the problem. And now I met you guys and you have a solution. I'm not so unique after all. Now, the ego has three jobs: make me right, make me different, and make me feel good right now. And because it says make me different, there are people in this group right now that may be thinking, that goes well for you, Harlan, but I'm different. You don't understand. I'm different. No, you're not. And if you do what we do, you will recover. No, you're not. And Clancy Imeslin speaks of this a lot. He says, every alcoholic who has been in program for a while and dies drunk goes to God and says, why didn't you help me? And God says, I sent you a book. I sent you meetings. I sent you a fellowship. And the alcoholic says to God, you don't understand. My case is different. And that's the ego. The ego will reinforce to you in every way it can that you are somehow unique and different when indeed you are not. And if you do what we do, you will recover. Recovery is not for a chosen few. Recovery is not for an elite class of compulsive overeating. And if it was, I wouldn't be here today. I would be dead. Recovery is not for the people who deserve it. Recovery is not for people unlike you. And it's not for people who need it. And it's not for people who want it. Recovery is for people who do it. Don't sit there and try to challenge God in your mind and heart and say, F you, God, bring me recovery. Strike me abstinent. You're going to die in the food. You will die never having lived. Death is going to come to us all. Death is going to come to us all. We're all going to die, whether we're Bill Wilson died, Dr. Bob died, Clancy died, Fitz died, Jimmy Burwell died. They all died. I'm going to die too. It's not whether you die, it's did you live? The mark of it is the dash. When I die, there's going to be something on my headstone that says, Harlan Grabowski, 1954, dash, whatever. What did you do with the dash? What did you do in that time between life and death? What did you do? Did you maximize it? Did you live to the fullest? Did you live? That's the question, because this is not a dress rehearsal. I don't give a damn how old you are. And as I look, I can't see everybody. I can only see this page that I'm on. So there's 20 of you or something. Some of you are young and some of you are not so young. Did you live? Because I don't care if you're 8 or 80. If there's breath in you, go live your life in recovery. Most of most of my dad's friends came out of concentration camps in Europe, primarily Auschwitz, because my father had many Polish Jewish friends. We lived in Chicago, so Chicago is the second highest Polish population in the world next to Warsaw. And most of them, when they would see me as a child, would pinch my cheek and they would say, live until you die. And I believe that live until you die meant that you ate as many Milky Way bars as you could get your hands on, because to me, that was living. And it took me until I was in my 40s, 30s, to realize, no, that's not what they're talking about. They're not talking about some hedonistic, eat what you want, do what you want thing. No. They're talking about recovery. They're talking about life. I've lived in the disease. No, I've existed in the disease. I've lived in the recovery. There is no life for me in the food. It's a guilt-ridden, shame-ridden, fear-ridden, anger-ridden life. And I hate myself when I'm in the food. When I'm not in the food and I'm in recovery, I live life to the fullest. Now, what is it you want? This is not a dress rehearsal. This is it, baby. You don't get to come back and do it again. I wish we did, but we don't. This is it, baby. The lights are on. The music is playing. The orchestra has been struck. You're on stage. Here comes the light, and it's your ball game. What are you going to do with it? We have recovered. Continuing on, bottom of 17, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out in which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. Not a program for people who need it. Not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. This book is going to carry you not only the news of recovery, but it is going to show you exactly what you have to do and when you have to do it, if you are open to it. If you're closed and you don't want this, there's not much we can do for you. Top of page 18. An illness of this sort, we have come to believe it, an illness involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it there goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. Stop trying to blame your mother. Stop trying to blame your father. Stop trying to blame your earthly conditions on this. You are not a compulsive overeater because of your bastard husband. You are not a compulsive overeater because of your dad. You are not a compulsive overeater because of your mother. Those may seem plausible to you. They are untrue. There is nobody or nothing that can make you a compulsive overeater. Oh, they can make you hungry. Oh, I'll give you that. They can make you hungry. But they are not the reason that you are a compulsive overeater. The reason that you are a compulsive overeater is also not your fault. This didn't happen because you're lazy. This didn't happen because you're stupid. This didn't happen because you failed to do A or B or C. This didn't happen for any of those reasons. This happened because it happened. Why do you have brown hair? Why do you now have gray hair? Why are you as tall as you are or as short as you are? Why do you have blue eyes or brown eyes? And this is the same exact thing. You have this because you have this. Now, what are you going to do about it? Nobody gave this to you. This is not a communicable disease. And in the questions and answers, don't assail me with, yeah, but you don't understand. My mother used food as a reward. Yeah, bullshit. Your mother used the same reward on your brothers and sisters, and they didn't become compulsive overeaters. And your mother used the same tactics to raise you as she did your siblings, and they didn't become compulsive overeaters. Maybe they did. I don't know. I wasn't there. Maybe you're like me. I'm an only child. Your mother used food on you because it worked. It calmed you down. It sated you because it gave you the effect. Mothers are smart. They use what they have to do to calm you down. And when you were crying and when you were this, mom said, I'll get you a toy. And that didn't calm you down. And then mom said, here, pet the dog. That didn't calm you down. And mom said, I'll make you pancakes. And that calmed you down. So she learned that pancakes works better than a toy or money or God knows what. She learned how to communicate with you. And in the life of a compulsive, and some of you are parents and did the same thing, but she didn't make you a compulsive overeater. No one did, except happenstance. And this will be the best blessing of your life. This will give you the best life and the best relationship, not only with yourself, but with God, that you could ever have imagined. And it is the most beautiful, fantastic way of life under the sun. There is no way of life more unbelievably fabulous than this. Embrace this. Embrace your compulsive overeating. And how do you embrace it? By recovering. Don't waste the time you have in the food. You've wasted enough time in the food. I found that for me, the best life is in the recovery, not in the food. I find that for me, life expands when I'm in recovery and contracts when I'm in the food. The food makes my life very small. I start shunning friends. Of course, my romantic relationship would never have been possible in the food. There's no way. My economic life suffers. I'm not a good worker when I'm uncomfortable in my skin. I find the greatest way of life is in recovery. Let's continue. Page 18, middle of the page. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. There are many. Highly competent psychiatrists have dealt with us, who have dealt with us, have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor. Now, this next part is in italics. They spent money that they didn't have for this. Let's give it the honor it deserves. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. I am not going to tell my teachers why I eat so much. I am going to feel them out to see why they think I eat so much and play to that. And I had been doing that from the time I was 4 years old. Because the only people I was ever honest with about what was going on with me are you. Because I can't be honest in that world that doesn't include you, because they will never understand, and I know they won't understand. There's no sense explaining to a horse what it's like to be an otter. And there's no sense trying to explain to an otter what it's like to be a horse. They are both mammals, and they are both animals. And that's where the similarity ends. One lives in the water, one doesn't. One is a beast of burden, one is not. One eats fish and mollusks, and one eats grass and hay and oats. There's no explanation plausible. How are you going to explain one to the other? It is impossible. So I never answered those questions, also because I'll tell you the truth, I didn't know. They would ask me and ask me and ask me and ask me, why do you eat so much? Why can't you stay on your diet? And if I was honest with myself and I was honest with them, the answer is, I don't know. I don't know, but there is something inside of me that looked at the world and I didn't like what I saw, because it seemed to me that other people were laughing and joking and loving and living, and I couldn't. I didn't understand what it was like to dare to dream, to dare to live, to go out there and live my life. I didn't know what that was about, because I was always too scared, and money was a factor, and my weight was a factor, and everything became a factor, and I could not live my life as I would like to have lived it. But I was jealous of you, because you seemed to have that magic ingredient, whether it was money or youth or vim or vigor, that you could go live your life, but I could not. Somehow I looked at life through a fence, and then later a telescope, because I never felt a part of you. I feel a part of you. I am a part of the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous. I have friends in many, many cities in this country. There's very few places I can go where I don't know anybody. From New York to California, from Anchorage to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to San Diego, and up and back this country, there are people, I know them and they know me. Maybe we've not spent time together, but we're on the same meetings and they know more about me than my mother did and my father did, because you know right where I live. You speak and understand the language of the heart. I'm in therapy now too. I go to program, but I have a therapist, and I can be honest with my therapist because of this program. Because of this program. I couldn't be honest with anybody, let alone myself. I didn't understand what or why I was doing it. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't get it. Now I understand that food is blocking me from getting honest with anybody about anything. I lied when the truth would have served me better. I lied when the truth would have been so much better. Now I don't have to do that anymore. And I don't have to have such a good memory anymore. I don't have to have such a good memory because I can remember the truth. I can remember the truth. Okay? Let's go to the next paragraph, and we're going to be done here pretty soon for today. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except a sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. I am madly, madly in love with somebody who explained to me something I never knew, because I never studied the New Testament in my life. She told me the story of the Bethesda Springs or something, that they took up their mats and walked again. And this is a Christian reference, which is fine. And she told me the story of that. And I never knew that before, because as a little Jewish boy, I never studied the New Testament before. But she's well versed in it. So she told me the story. But anyway, you can get up from where you are, and you will be amazed before you are halfway through. You will be amazed before you are halfway through. You walk to God and see if he doesn't run to you. Test God, challenge God. You will not find him lacking. That this program works, and when it works, it universally works for all of us, but it works for you. Imagine. I don't know why I got muted, but I did. Okay. It will work for you. I am healing in areas of my life I didn't even know were broken. I'm a better worker, a better friend, a better person because of this recovery than I ever could have been. I am living my life. I walk 3 miles a day, 6 days a week, and it makes me like myself because I'm doing something for me. The two permanent relationships, the one with me and the one with God, are enhanced every day because of this program. Test God, walk to God, work the program, see where you can find him lacking. I doubt you can. I doubt you can find him lacking. I just know in my mind that the age of miracles is still upon us, and you will be amazed before you are halfway through. You're going to be astounded, astounded at what you're going to find in life. You're going to be in places you never thought possible. Okay, we're going to turn this over to somebody. I'll turn it back over to Dottie or Veronica. I don't remember who's doing this. I'm going to turn it back over to them and let them fight it out. But before we do the questions and answers, let me just remind you of something. We are having a retreat. The Scottsdale group is having a retreat. And that retreat is going to be in Phoenix, Arizona, July 12th, 13th, and 14th. We are hoping that you will come. To register for this big book retreat, go to oaphoenix.org. That's oaphoenix.org and register for this retreat. You will be glad you did. It's going to be fun. We're going to do some good work. We are hoping to see you. Let's get together in July and let's get some good work done. You'll expand your God squad. It's going to be great. OAPhoenix.org, July 12th, 13th, and 14th. Come and join us. We'll be so happy you did. All right, no math and no food questions. No math, no food. And if you asked a question last week, wait till it dies down before you ask one this week, okay? All right, back to you, Dottie and Veronica.